This is MSO News Sports. I'm Bill Newell, and we are joined by Salem State Representative Manny Cruz joining us here on the line. Rep, thank you. Thanks for joining us.
Such a pleasure to be with you, Bill, as always.
And we are here to get some updates on what's happening in Boston at the legislature. And first up, let me hear from you on this supplemental budget that has been, pretty much agreed to, right?
Absolutely, Bill. So I'm pleased to report that last week the supplemental budget was finalized. So that is our close end of year budget, and there have been several, I think, smaller supplemental budgets that have been filed, and between the Senate, the House, and the governor. I think there were a variety of approaches, but ultimately, where the legislature landed was taking on one big omnibus supplemental budget that included items that were not resolved during the regular budgeting process, addressing some of the funding for the current migrant and family shelter crisis that we're experiencing here in the Commonwealth, and then additionally meeting a whole host of other needs here within the state, but in particular, some of the contracts for our state employees who had been bargaining at the table for some time and had earned some contractual increases. So, but there's a lot of good stuff in the sup, and happy to dive in where you think most appropriate, Bill.
Well, tell me about the migrant funding piece and whether that's just a chunk of money to be determined or whether it's already been targeted to different areas, in particular Salem or other North Shore communities.
Yeah, so this is a great question, Bill. So with respect to the more recent waves of migration, what we've experienced here in the Commonwealth is not unique. There are many other states that have welcomed migrants that have been seeking asylum. And in the Commonwealth's particular case, we are one of the few states that has a right to shelter for families. And the SJC pretty clearly determined that that right to shelter law applies to all regardless of immigration status or asylum-seeking status as well. And so over the last year or so, what we saw in our Commonwealth was a very clear uptick in the number of migrants coming to the Commonwealth, in addition to a rising homeless population and the fastest growing segment of that being families. And so right from the onset of the Keeley Driscoll administration, ongoing conversations with both municipalities, with state legislators about how to approach providing shelter and moving folks through the system, while at the same time advocating for comprehensive immigration reform at the federal level. And what you saw here in the Commonwealth was that we had reached, I think, a critical point in which the administration realized from, a resource standpoint that we were nearing our capacity within the original budget that was filed to meet the needs of communities and migrants throughout the Commonwealth. And so as a result, Governor Healey and Lieutenant Governor Driscoll filed a supplemental budget with the intent of being able to provide those resources. Now, one of the things that also came up was the Healey-Driscoll administration, appearing before the courts, was given, a narrow carve-out to create a cap on the number of families that could be in the family shelter system. That cap number was about 7,500 families. Now, where the issue was, in the differences between how the House, the Senate, and the governor wanted to approach this particular issue was, from the House's perspective, we obviously have more members, 160 folks on the ground. We're seeing firsthand the impacts of the migrant crisis to our housing stock, to shelter sites that were being propped up across the state. But one of the things that was always of concern was what happens after you hit 7,500. So the House, I think, took a really principled stance on ensuring dignity for all of our families experiencing homelessness by saying that, Governor, respectfully, we do want to give you the funds needed to ensure that folks are able to shelter, be tracked through our system, and provided the supports needed. However, I think one of the things that we wanted to make sure was that once we hit that cap of 7,500, that there would be a condition that within 30 days of enactment of the supplemental budget, that the governor and the administration would identify a plan for an overflow site so that folks would not be left to sleep in Logan Airport, in the libraries. And quite frankly, the reality is, Bill, that folks were going to end up doubled up in our communities. And without a clear plan for how we were managing overflow, I think what we would have landed with was we would have lost track of a lot of families in this harrowing situation. And so folks may have read the papers and saw that there was this delay in the supplemental budget. And I do want to note that there were a lot of great items that were in there. But this was, a real principle disagreement, and I think everyone was acting in good faith, trying to wrestle with a really difficult situation. I think whereas the Senate and the governor saw the need for flexibility with the funding at the onset of the negotiations, I think by the end, I think everybody recognized that this was the best path forward to ensure that as we think about overflow sites and providing services to families experiencing homelessness, that there's a clear plan in place and that the legislature is receiving that report back. So we have some level of oversight, accountability, and that continued partnership between the three branches there, between House, Senate, and the governor. So, and the result of that bill, and this will be my last point before we jump into some of the other good pieces that were in there, was that I think fundamentally we came to an agreement that this was the best path forward. But I do recognize and I want to acknowledge that for a lot of different organizations, for some of the union contracts that were in there, transportation funding, you name it, it meant a lot of folks had to wait a little bit longer than expected. So I do, in the spirit of, I think, transparency and accountability, I want to apologize to my constituencies, but I hope that they understand with this context that this is fundamentally about ensuring human rights and dignity and keeping families safe in what looks to be another cold winter here in our Commonwealth. And ultimately, I recognize processes can be imperfect, but the result is all of those other obligations that were in that supplemental budget, they are going to be met, and we're going to be able to, I think, support these families as well.
You know, Manny, I have really one kind of follow-up area on the supplemental, and you mentioned the kind of that ripple effect of the state budget to local communities, none so more than education. Now, right now, it's hard to believe we're here in December, but January, cities and towns all around the state are preparing for the next fiscal budget, which would be July 1, 2024. But they need to know, you know, where the state is financially and so on. And what can you share with us? And as far as education is concerned, you have not only the Salem Public Schools in your district, but you also have Salem State. So is there anything to share regarding either the supplemental or how it might impact or what the look is at education funding moving forward here?
Yeah, it's a great question, Bill. So with respect to municipal budgets and education funding, there's a few things coming down the pike. So I think we should talk about the state of the economy and the revenues that are being collected. So Massachusetts is not unique in this, but we are seeing some slowed growth here in our Commonwealth. And currently, there is the Ways and Means Committee is hosting members of the administration and trying to come up with consensus revenue projections and numbers for the upcoming fiscal year. As the governors and her administration and the various secretariats, they're in the process of developing their budgets for the next year. But one of the things that we do know is that when we look at some of the revenues that have been collected, it's the first time in a long time that we had four straight months in which the Commonwealth did not meet its kind of baseline with respect to those revenue collections, which shows that the economy might be slowing down a little bit. And so what that means is for our state, for our municipalities, that we're probably going to see a little bit more, fiscal restraint to just ensure that we're living within our means as a state. Now, there's a couple of things that are happening concurrently. So, and this is going to be specific to the education issue. We're approaching year 5 and 6 of the implementation of the Student Opportunity Act, landmark legislation that was filed now a few sessions ago that revamped the funding formula. So all of our municipalities that benefited from SOA are going to continue to see that investment from our fiscal budget. There is the millionaire's tax that was recently passed last year by the voters, and those revenues came in a little bit over what was anticipated, and much of that funding went towards things like universal school meals for families. Some of that funding has been used to create new programs like, as an example, there's a brand new tuition expansion program called Mass Grant Plus, in which students meeting certain income levels are going to be able to attend our institutions of public higher education for free. And it's really exciting to see those new type of investments. But where the challenges lie in education, Bill, are specifically around the cost of transportation. That continues to, I think, be a budget buster for many of our local school districts. And then additionally, you have a real, I think, crisis, if you will, around special education and out-of-district placements and some of the rate increases that we've seen as high as 14% plus for many of our districts. And the reasoning for that is around workforce. Educator workforce is really, I think, throughout our Commonwealth, we're wrestling with this idea that we're not compensating folks enough in K through 12, early education, but certainly in specialized fields like special education as well. So many of the providers that provide those out-of-district placements, there's going to be a rate increase to pay for the staffing to be able to retain folks, recruit people, attract them to the profession. And what that means for a lot of districts is what you'll see, over the next several months is many of them are going to be talking about not only increasing their special education budgets, but in many cases, some of these districts are going to require to do overrides in order to make themselves whole with respect to their budgets. So that's kind of the landscape, if you will, with what we might see coming down the pike, which is as we're now weaning districts off of the federal kind of COVID emergency dollars in ESSER and ARPA, we're going back to a situation in which many of these districts that have layered on some additional supports, those are going to come off the fiscal sheets, and then we're all going to be left with kind of addressing what we know are going to continue to be rising costs, which are around education, special education, tuition rates, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, I understand exactly what you're saying. I mean, the inflation that people are seeing at the grocery store definitely impacting what you just mentioned with those special ed outplacements and so on. So well said. I agree with you. Yeah, that's a big impact thing. And we've already seen that in some towns around the North Shore about this special ed piece, for sure. Is there anything else you want to share with us? You gave a big, broad overview of the supplemental budget, but anything else that you want to kind of zero in on before we move to other things here on the supplemental?
Yeah, absolutely. So if I could, I'd love to highlight just a couple of, just to give folks some updates. I think the last time you and I spoke, Bill, I had mentioned that I had filed 30 pieces of legislation. And since our conversation, 29 of those bills have had hearings. And if I could just elevate a couple of, bills that I've been working on in some areas. The first one I want to talk about is the bill that I filed that is related to expanding access to computer science, universal access to computer science here in our Commonwealth. At the moment, what we have is a patchwork of districts that are offering some type of computer science coursework within their course of studies, and then some that are not even offering even the most fundamental of computer science courses. We're fortunate to have that in Salem, and more affluent communities are more likely to have these types of programs. And what this means for our gateway cities and communities that don't have a requirement for some type of computer science-based coursework is that our students are at potentially a disadvantage in the workforce. So the bill that I filed, what it would do is it would require every school district in our Commonwealth to actually provide a computer science-related course. And there have been some really great reports that have come out about the impact of the computer science field in particular, and I'd like to highlight one from the Massachusetts Business Alliance for Education, which published a report several years ago entitled Expanding Access and Participation in Computer Science Across Massachusetts. And what it uncovered, you know, Bill, just to give you a picture of the stark reality, is that only about 6% of high school students were enrolled in a computer science course. And when it came to what this means for our students of color, students from multilingual backgrounds, or students that are economically disadvantaged, they were even disproportionately less enrolled in these types of courses. And the nation's median wage is about $41,000 for all occupations, whereas with computer science, we're talking about $90,000 in wages and salary. And what that means for our students is that this is an opportunity for prosperity and mobility. And so by at least providing this baseline level of access, we get more exposure to a STEM field that I think is really important. So as we think about our Commonwealth, you know, one of the things that I always hear folks talk about is Massachusetts being number one in education in the country based on our standardized assessments. But these are the types of equity gaps that exist. And I think bills like this are just so important. And so it had its hearing a couple of months ago, and I'm going to continue to advocate for this particular issue, especially coming out of the pandemic, as I know that one of the things that we cannot do is we cannot return to 2019. All of our kids need to have the opportunity to understand their roles as digital citizens and to really have robust access to digital literacy, devices, and the internet in order to thrive and to be engaged citizens and really, I think, dynamic prospective employees someday. So that's one bill that I'd love to highlight, and I'll continue to advocate for its passage during the Joint Rule 10 kind of deadline that's been set for February. The other bill that I want to highlight.
Let me just interrupt you for a second, in the sense that young high school students can navigate the internet. That's not the issue here, I would imagine, but from what I know, being in schools. But the issue is to have the skills to do programs that you would use in an employment environment. Does that sound right, what you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely, Bill. So it's everything from being able to use the Microsoft Suite, so whether the more sophisticated tools, PowerPoint, Excel spreadsheets, the use of AI, I mean, you name it, computer science coursework can really take a life of its own. And in Salem, we're fortunate to have a Chapter 74 program, which turns our kind of computer science coursework into a career vocational technical program. So we have a little bit more of an immersive program. One of the things that I'd highlight because of our investment in this particular area in Salem is that we were recently able to launch a partnership for our students in this computer science kind of course to be able to work with a company called BrainCo. And BrainCo develops what's known as brain-computer interface. It is a headband that essentially students could put on and they could use it to program a prosthetic. And the starting salaries in this particular field are about $180,000. So when you think about what it means to get to a higher level of sophistication with digital literacy skills, we're really talking about our students engaging in the jobs of the future and really being highly skilled. So that is the goal, Bill. You're absolutely right.
No, and I'm glad you were able to clarify that a little bit. I think you really brought the point home. Every job now, you know, requires some of those skills you just mentioned, many of those skills for sure, because of the recording, record keeping, and so on and so forth. But all right, I interrupted you, but Manny, continue on with some of the other legislation that you've filed, and you know, will be heard.
Thank you, Bill, and no worries at all. I think the other bill that I would just love to highlight is one that is, I think, near and dear to our folks in Salem. I have filed legislation to try to address an issue with respect to the timing of the release of regional tourism grants. I'm pleased to report back to our community that we were able to kind of resolve this particular issue both in the budget and the supplemental budget for this particular fiscal year. But what my legislation would do is essentially we have these regional tourism grants that are released to various organizations across the Commonwealth that are charged with promoting year-round all of our respective communities and their sites of visitation. And the issue is that the way in which these funds are released is more so on a quarterly basis, which from a business perspective, you want to be able to have a strategic plan, get your marketing dollars allocated throughout the year, and you want to know what's coming with certainty and when. So my legislation would set forth a consensus date from all the stakeholders who engage with these particular grants and with the Massachusetts Office of Tourism to say that sometime in December, these particular grantees would receive the funding year to year, same time frame, and they'd get the whole year's worth of funding so that they could actually plan for the visitation year round. And the reason why this matters so much, Bill, is because as a Commonwealth, our third leading industry is the tourism industry. And the tourism industry extends well beyond just the impact of being able to visit the PBD Essex Museum, the Witch Museum, and many of the other great attractions in Salem. Visitation is the lifeblood for many local communities when it comes to the preservation of our history, keeping our restaurants and our service workers with stable revenues and income. But then also, I think the majesty of being able to activate communities throughout our Commonwealth. So I think we've made some really great progress to get some of these issues rectified for the year. And I feel really hopeful that this is a bill that we'd be able to get done in this year, especially, I think, having a friend in the corner office who I think really understands, Lieutenant Governor Driscoll, the importance of that predictability in our tourism industry.
No, absolutely. There's a lot more to it than putting on a costume and prowling around the streets in the city of Salem in October.
Absolutely.
Hey, you also have legislation. You filed legislation on family health, right, or related to family health issues?
That's right. That's right. So I filed a couple of different things. And so just to give folks a little bit of context, if you may recall, Bill, a couple of years ago, conversations began around the decision to close the North Shore Birthing Center in Beverly. And that's actually where my wife and I decided that we wanted to have our child, our daughter, Ivy Sophia, who was born there a couple of years ago now. And my experience at the birthing center was an amazing experience as a father and as a partner to my wife. And my wife did all the research about birthing centers, their outcomes for low risk pregnancies. And during the pandemic, I didn't have a chance to be as involved in the pregnancy as I would have liked with respect to visits because of the rules at the time. But as soon as I walked through the doors of the North Shore Birthing Center, I completely understood why my wife had chosen this particular option for our family. And so, regrettably, with the closure of the birthing center, what we've done is we've turned our Commonwealth into a real desert when it comes to options for birthing and for families. And so we used to be a state that had two birthing centers. We're down to just one freestanding birthing center that may emerge in Boston given the conditions. But I filed legislation, Bill, that would prevent in the future closures of birthing centers as an essential service by updating certain regulations that would ensure that our Commonwealth has a little bit more teeth to be able to protect this critical piece of access for our families. And this particular legislation did have a great hearing earlier in the fall. And there's been some movement from the administration, which I'm really excited about. I think sometimes when you file bills, you're always hopeful that you'll be able to get your bill to the floor, but sometimes they serve as a conversation starter with respect to some of the issues that might be housed within the administration. So we feel really excited to share that Governor Healey and her administration and the Attorney General have worked really diligently on trying to expand access to midwifery care and birthing centers, and that we're hopeful that all the elements that are within the bill will get done.
I think everybody listening to you right now would want me to follow up with this one question. Is there any chance of this kind of service returning to the North Shore moving forward? I mean, is it economically possible that it would, that it could happen?
So there's certainly, I think, a chance, Bill, that we certainly see another birthing center here in the North Shore. There's an entire coalition that was formed following the closure, and I know that folks have really come in earnest to try to find land and property and a company that would be interested in raising up another birthing center within our region. So as I understand it, they're still out there exploring potential options and certainly trying to put some pen to paper with respect to a fundraising strategy to be able to sustain the opening of a birthing center. So I'm excited about the prospects from what I've heard from some of the advocates that I've worked with in coalition. And I'm hopeful that there will be one that opens.
Gotcha. Perfect. All right. Now, another issue that I know came up in the recent Salem Mayor's race was the South Station, the Salem South Station, or the possibility of the South Station in Salem. Do you have any updates to share with us on that project, MBTA project?
This is a top priority for me. I talked about this one, Bill, a fair amount on the trail, and I'm not surprised that it was an area where in the last mayoral special election, there was a lot of conversation about this particular project. I'm pleased to share that with respect to the Salem South Station, that things are progressing. The city already had in place an MOU, a Memorandum of Understanding, with the MBTA around a potential project. And the momentum that started under the Driscoll administration is continuing into the Pangallo administration. Just a couple of weeks ago, I joined the mayor, city leaders, our planning department, and members of MBTA and Keolis in beginning a working group conversation around this particular project. So there are some proposed sites that have been identified. The central idea, Bill, is to create access for two of our largest employers, North Shore Medical Center, Salem Hospital, and Salem State University. And the Salem Partnership has really played a tremendous role in shepherding the process and advocating for this particular issue. So I think one of the things that came out of this first meeting was very clear. I think we're going to get to consensus around a design at some point. The MBTA is excited about the project, given our proximity, again, to some institutions that would serve the entire line. Salem is one of the most trafficked areas when it comes to our current stop, and this would create a tremendous amount of equity for communities like Boston, Lynn, and Chelsea to access our institutions here in Salem, like Salem Hospital and Salem State University. Now, one of the things that I know will certainly be on my charge will be to support the funding that they're going to need for the Salem South Station design process. So I am in communication with my colleagues in the legislature about this project, and I'm hopeful that I'll be able to do some advocacy either in the upcoming economic development bill or in the budget to be able to secure some funding that would be needed for this particular project and to get it off the ground. We're fortunate that Congressman Moulton has already done some of the legwork with respect to advocating for some funding around this project, and that we have a city administration that is willing to work really collaboratively with the MBTA to try to get to yes on this particular project. So that's the latest I can give you, is that we've had our first session and that folks, the various stakeholders, have their marching orders. And as the state rep, I'll be doing all that I can to ensure that we get the funding that's necessary to be able to move the design process forward.
You know, that is has such great potential, because in a location, and I don't know exactly where that would be, but you, like you said, there's Salem State there and the Salem Hospital and the North Shore Medical Center, all within really reasonable walking distance. If you could get a station in that area, it would be huge, I would think, for both institutions.
Absolutely. And depending on the design of the station, you'd actually be connecting two parts of Salem,
yeah,
to make us, again, a more walkable city. So if you designed in some of the particular areas where Salem State and Salem Hospital meet, where there's not currently a bridge that gets you from one site to the other, if we were to able to to build some type of overhead, you know, bridge that allowed folks to cross seamlessly to the station, we'd be able to connect two parts of Salem that you would normally have to drive all the way around to get to. So I'm really optimistic that this project will also provide us with that level of connection as well.
Yeah, you don't have to respond to this, but if you think about it, you could work at Salem Hospital, you could go to school at Salem State, you know, and you can't do that now. You know, there's no way you could do that, you know, with a stop where it is down in downtown Salem. So, yeah, I mean, it's just a fantastic idea, to be honest with you, yeah. All right, let me ask you about, you mentioned Mayor Pangallo, so now you have Mayor Pangallo at City Hall in Salem, you got Senator Lovely, Lieutenant Governor Driscoll, the former mayor of Salem down in Boston, of course, the Healey administration. Politically, what can you share with us about, and of course, Senator Lovely, with this coalition of partners that, what political updates can you share with us as far as the partnerships that have been going on and the collaboration with that, with all the leaders?
Absolutely, Bill. Happy to share some insights. So I think we're fortunate here in Salem to have a really cohesive team of leaders leading our city. I always talk about Salem and leading Salem as a team effort. We have really, I think, deliberative municipal bodies between the city council and the school committee. And then certainly, you know, between myself, the senator, the mayor, we keep in close contact. We have a monthly check-in. And we're working together to really advance Salem throughout the state. And having Lieutenant Governor Driscoll, who has so much familiarity with Salem, is certainly to our benefit as a community. Just today, as a matter of fact, the mayor welcomed Lieutenant Governor Driscoll, along with several other key dignitaries, Secretary Augustus, to announce that Salem and Lexington are the first two communities to comply with what is known as the MBTA Communities Law, which requires municipalities that have some type of MBTA transit-related property to develop housing and submit a plan in compliance with the state. And we are well above compliance. We're proactive. And that type of, I think, partnership between the city and the state is possible because the folks that are at the table are working towards similar goals. So we have a lot of cohesion and I think respect for each other as colleagues. And I think having the Lieutenant Governor who has previously served as a mayor is certainly advantageous for Salem, but really for our region and for the whole state. I think I'm always in awe of Lieutenant Governor Driscoll's ability to be able to relay to folks on the ground level that she was one of them, right? She was a mayor in a city where there's accountability every single day in the corner office. You're fixing potholes, you're passing school budgets, and her leadership has really, I think, emerged throughout the state. And I'm pleased to see the way that this administration has approached partnership. And I think for myself, the senator, and the mayor, to have a rhyme and a rhythm with respect to how we're working together, it means that Salem's going to be well served. With the three of us kind of working together in that way.
Well, Salem State Representative Manny Cruz is with us. And Manny, I'm down to maybe my last two questions the last one being an open-ended thing for you to follow up on anything you'd like to. But Manny, the big news in Salem in the last several weeks is the Salem High Super Bowl appearance down at Gillette. Unfortunately, they didn't come away with a win, but they were right there at the end. But I know you're pretty excited about the Witches football season this year, right?
I certainly am. I had the distinct pleasure of being able to go to a couple of the games this season, and it was truly a magical season for our community. And I just want to express how proud I am of our Salem High football players and the way that they comported themselves throughout the season. It took many years for us to build up a program again that reflected, I think, some of the memories that folks will have of Salem as a powerhouse athletically. So to make it back to the Super Bowl, sometimes it is about the process and the journey. We didn't get the result that we were seeking, but having gone to Gillette in support of our students, I saw their grit, their resilience, their unity as a team on full display, and they showed a lot of heart, and they gave us, even right up to the end, some magic and made us believe that it was certainly possible. And I know that we have a lot of seniors on the team, and we'll have some folks that returned. But I think one thing that's clear to me, Bill, is that these young men gave Salem an amazing storybook experience this year, and I'm looking forward for years to come to see what else the future generation of Salem High football players are able to achieve. And I think one of the things that always struck me, I got to spend a lot of time with the players leading up to the game through the Bridging the Gap ceremony that happens between Salem and Beverly, in which for 40 years now we've come together to talk about the importance of sportsmanship, leadership, and our two communities being unified, and a rivalry not getting in the way of that. But I think knowing how much has been put into the season, not just by the players, but by the cheerleaders, by the band, by our boosters, our parents, and there were so many folks that were involved with this season, and I know that all of those stakeholders are just tremendously proud, what I hope is that this remains a source of pride for these young men who had this magical experience. I don't think they're ever going to forget the fact that they played in the Super Bowl, and regardless of the final score, in my view, they were incredibly successful.
Yeah, you know, they're a great group of kids, and they're and what they achieved is spectacular as well, because they're a great group of athletes, and you know, just athletes themselves. And of course, Coach Matt Bouchard has done a nice job. It didn't happen overnight, as you mentioned, but it's a great story, a fantastic story. And you know, they're not surprised they were there, but I think they surprised a lot of other people around the North Shore for sure. And again, a great story. Manny, anything else you want to share with us? You know, from the State House, from the legislature, or whatever.
There's two quick things that I would love to share. So I did want to report back about the regular budgeting process. Just one of my victories in the budget, I was able to successfully advocate with Senator Lovely and Dan Cahill of Lynn, State Representative Dan Cahill of Lynn, for a $2.5 million investment in the Salem Family Health Center for them to be able to build a new health center right in the heart of downtown, in my old neighborhood, in the Point neighborhood. And that $2.5 million that we secured is going to go towards a capital campaign to be able to build a new state-of-the-art family health center that is going to have some housing, but really, I think the main thing that I would love to emphasize for our residents about this project is, yes, we were able to secure some funding, which is very exciting, but we're going to need all hands on deck so that we can finally have a health center that matches the needs of our patients and can provide them with dignity within the space. And they're going to be launching a capital campaign in which they're going to be asking members of our community to be able to donate and to kind of etch their own investment in such a vital resource for our community. So I wanted to make a plug for that, for folks to be following the Salem Family Health Center on social media, signing up for their email campaign so that we're able to help bring that dream to a reality. I was a patient at the Salem Family Health Center. My mother, my grandmother are currently still patients there. I got my dental care there for most of my adolescence and my youth. And then I went there for my regular pediatric visits, and I had a wonderful experience. But I know that the state of that facility is one that leaves something to be desired for all of our patients, and they've done their best. So this project would be, I think, a welcomed addition here in Salem. And then the other piece that I'll just make a plug for is that on December 18th, I will be having my final office hours for the year at the Community Life Center from 9:30 to about 11 a.m. So would love to see my constituents as we approach the holiday season. I'm just so grateful for them and their engagement, and want to make sure that they know that I'll be waiting with them for them with open arms on Monday with coffee, donuts, and maybe some holiday goodies as well.
Wow, that sounds great. All right. Well, Manny, we really appreciate all the time and insights you've been able to share with us, and wish you a great holiday for you and your family. And again, we really appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
Thank you so much, Bill, for having me, and looking forward to joining you once again in the new year.
You got it. Manny Cruz, State Rep, City of Salem, and I'm Bill Newell here on MSONewsSports.com.